Hey friends, welcome back to the Journal Feed. My name is Nick Zelt, and this is the only place where I get to provide to you emergency medicine literature. Whole bunch of recent articles appraised and concisely summarized just for you. If you are hearing this right now, though, then you are not currently a Journal Feed subscriber, and so you will not be receiving the full Journal Feed podcast, only getting a portion of the past week's articles. Don't worry, they're all good. But if you would like to get full access to both the podcast and the blog, then you'll have to become a member. All the details for that are at journalfeed.org. And remember, we never want money to be a barrier to better patient care. So if you're having any trouble affording a subscription, get in touch and we'll help you out. Also, it's really quite cheap for residents, just saying. This is the audio version of the past week summaries, which this week were brought to you by our authors at the Journal Feed: Samuel Rouleau, Aaron Lacey, Ketan Patel, Abigail Limov, Doug Wallace, Clark Strunk, and of course, Clay Smith. All right, so let's get right into the first article titled Lower versus Higher Oxygen Target and Days Alive Without Life Support in COVID-19, the Hot COVID Randomized Clinical Trial out of the JAMA. Now, as you may or may not know, there's been a lot of interest in recent years about the ideal oxygen levels that we should use as targets for our patients. The overall trend is, of course, that too much oxygen isn't just not beneficial, but it's also likely harmful. This has resulted in recommendations, such as that from the Surviving Sepsis Guidelines, just as an example, to target oxygen saturation somewhere between 90 and 96%, even in critically ill patients. Now, the HOT ICU trial from 2021 compared high and low oxygen targets, comparing a PaO2 of 60 millimeters of mercury to 90 millimeters of mercury. This roughly correlates to SpO2 saturations, like you would get on your little finger probe, of 90 to about 96%. In that trial, there was no difference in the 90-day mortality, which was the primary outcome. But with the lower target group, there was an association with significantly fewer days requiring life support. Now, during the COVID pandemic, everyone seems to have gotten the impression somehow that COVID infections were drastically different than all the other respiratory diseases that we know and love. I'm not sure that there's necessarily been anything to totally convince me of this sentiment, but I suppose it is possible. And so here we have the HOT COVID trial. Pretty much the same thing as the HOT ICU trial, except for it was specifically with COVID patients. Again, comparing PaO2s of 60 to 90 millimeters of mercury as the targets, recruiting patients from multiple adult ICUs. Interesting to see in this trial was that it included many more patients than the HOT ICU trial who were not intubated, but did need ventilatory support, which is actually really great because BiPAP as long as possible really became the name of the game for COVID. This time, the authors, they got smart, and they made the primary outcome what was significant from, well, the HOT ICU trial. And again, they found a difference in days alive without life support, a mean difference of 5.8 days, which was statistically significant. This was mostly driven by days on mechanical ventilation. This also correlated with days out of the hospital, which is nice, and there was no significant difference, again, in mortality rates at 90 days. Sounds like COVID, well, it's not so different after all. An interesting finding from this study, which is only hypothesis generating, was that it seemed like there would have been a mortality benefit in patients with baseline shock, defined as vasopressor requirements and lactate above 2. The low oxygen target group seemed to have much better survival rates, but again, this was very small subgroups, so don't look into it too much. The HOT ICU trial, from my digging, doesn't seem to have included a subgroup analysis of these patients specifically. Overall, I'm presuming that this has no change on your current practice, as it doesn't change my current practice. I think that targeting O2 levels above 90 to 92% is pretty well established at this point. I know I'm certainly never targeting levels higher than 96. In a spoonful, the HOT COVID RCT found that hypoxemic COVID-19 patients in the ICU benefited from a lower oxygen target, PaO2s of 60 millimeters of mercury, and this benefit was seen through less days requiring life support compared to those with the higher oxygen targets of 90 millimeters of mercury. Presumably because we weren't striving for higher targets, and thus these patients could be extubated earlier or extubated later. Hard to say. And then we'll skip straight to the fifth article. Titled Emergency Department STEMI Patients with Initial Electrocardiogram Labeled Normal by Computer Interpretation, a 7-year retrospective review out of the journal Academic Emergency Medicine. All right, everybody, yet another publication by Drs. McLaren, Myers, and Smith cautioning against trusting the computer when it comes to ECGs. As I've explained before, Dr. Smith of Dr. Smith's ECG blog is something of an ECG guru and the driving force behind the OMI occlusion MI paradigm. This publication adds to a very long list of publications from this group with similar messages. In this case, they performed a multi-center retrospective cohort study from 2016 to 2022. They looked at the initial ECG computer interpretations of 536 patients who later went on to have emergent cardiac catheterizations from the emergency department as code STEMIs. 74% of these cath lab activations ended up having culprit lesions identified. 16 patients, or 4% of the cases that went on to the cath lab and were shown to have artery occlusions, well, their initial ECGs were read as normal by the computer. 6 of those 16 cases were identified by the ED physician as potentially representing ischemia, and this resulted in cath lab activation quite quickly. Looking a little bit at the details of these 16 cases that were outlined in the article, all of which had an ECG interpretations by the computer normal but went on to apparently have occlusions. One of them was seen after the troponins came back elevated and the ECG was interpreted as kind of suspect. This patient was referred to cardiology, who then activated the cath lab. 6 cases ended up having serial ECGs, presumably at the request of the ED physician, and all of these 6 developed STEMI criteria and cath lab activation. 5 more cases had suspicious changes on the initial ECG, resulting in either cath lab activation or cardiology consultation, and then 4 cases were referred to cardiology as NSTEMIs. Only 1 of the initial troponins was negative. In this case, serial ECGs developed De Winter T waves, and then the cath lab was activated. The authors use this data to argue that we can't trust the computer, and that all ECGs should be interpreted by the emergency physician, I guess, right away. Personally, I don't know. This looks like the system is working pretty well to me. I mean, don't get me wrong, I totally agree. It's definitely way more elegant to catch the OMI on the first pass and thus reduce the door to cath time. But we're not seeing patient-centered outcomes in this study, and it's not clear that in patients who have initially non-STEMI ECGs that a potential saving of what is usually seems like a few hours in terms of the door to cath time would be beneficial to them in reducing adverse events or long-term outcomes. It's a balance. There's a price to everything. It is a slightly earlier catch time in, frankly, 1% of patients with occlusions worth an unquantified, at least by this study, number of distractions in the emergency department. They didn't say how many ECGs total had to be reviewed in order to actually catch this very small proportion of patients. I don't think there's really a right answer, as these authors make it out to seem. Sure, in the ideal world, if the department wasn't exploding with patients in the waiting room and boarding patients, then I would very much agree that since the doctor has the time, they should look over the ECGs. Then they're reviewed, and this could help, and as they showed, this would help some patients. But as things are, I mean, I'm not totally sure. Already, where I work, the nurses walk directly up to the physician and interrupt, essentially, whatever they're doing to read the ECG. I think I personally would prefer a system where the ECG is put in plain sight in a little box near my desk, so that when I have a minute, I can check it. The guidelines recommend 10 minutes to ECG interpretation for the diagnosis of the STEMI, not 30 seconds, so it can probably wait until I finish my note, my phone call, or what have you. At least my thought. In a spoonful, a significant minority of code STEMI patients have an initial normal ECG by the computer interpretation. Consequently, emergency physicians should, of course, be very vigilant to identify signs of OMI regardless of what the computer says. And those are our articles from this week. Let's do a quick wrap-up. From the first article, even for COVID patients, targeting PaO2 levels of above 60 millimeters of mercury in ICU patients both isn't harmful and really looks like it's beneficial. And then from the fifth article, OMIs are missed by computer interpretations. We know this, but it's still a very small proportion of the population. Is that enough to justify constant interruptions? It's hard to say. Again, if you are hearing this right now, then you are not a part of the members feed, and so you missed three articles from this past week. What did you miss? Well, from one article, we were revisiting ET tube sizes recommended by the NRP. Are they really the right sizes? From another article, how many pediatric center transfers could robust telehealth prevent? And then lastly, a word of caution on the approaching artificially intelligent world. Links to all the articles summarized can be found at journalfeed.org. Just follow the links in the show notes. Our goal here is for you to read less, learn more, and save lives, one spoonful at a time. Thank you.